It's hard to think of a plant less mysterious than corn. You've seen it hundreds of times. It's predictable, possibly even boring. The background noise of every grocery aisle. We build mazes out of it. We pop it from movies and grind it into things we can't even pronounce on ingredient lists. But behind that everyday crop is one of the strangest, most scandalous stories in human history. A story of gods, genes, and greed. I'm Megan Braham, and on this episode of The History of Plants, we're diving into ZMA's corn. We engineered it from wild grass, crowned it into myth, and built economies and entire diets on its starch. We thought we'd bend it to our will, but in the end, we're the ones who submitted, reshaping our soil, economy, and some might say civilization itself. To see how that happened, we have to go back to where it all began, not in the prairies or the plains, but in a single valley in Mexico where the first farmers took a chance on a plant no one should have ever bothered with. Part one, the impossible plant. Corn didn't begin as golden rose or waving fields. It started as a stubborn grass in the Balsas River Valley of southwestern Mexico. Small, wiry, almost inedible. Its ancestor, Teosinte, was a scraggly wild grass with just a few rock-hard kernels trapped in shells that were so tough you could break a tooth. You could chew one once. After that, probably not. Taxonomically, corn belongs to the Poaceae family, the same grass family that rebuilt Earth after the dinosaurs fell. As I talked about in the grass episode, these plants didn't conquer the world through size or strength, but through chemistry. Their secret weapon was C4 photosynthesis, which is basically an upgraded photosynthetic engine that traps carbon more efficiently, like a turbocharger for sunlight. Teosinte carried that same molecular trick. It was born to survive the dry spells and high sun of Mesoamerica. The very trait that lets grass turn continents green also let this unremarkable weed become the foundation of empires. Within that dynasty, corn sits in the genus Zea, Zea maize as its single domesticated species, a plant that's more invention than organism. Unlike its ancestors, its kernels don't drop to the soil, they cling to the cob, utterly dependent on humans to exist. It's not just cultivated, it's curated. And while maize left no fossils in the traditional sense, it did leave chemical fingerprints. The earliest traces show up not as bones or leaves, but as microscopic silica bodies called phytoliths, which are tiny glass signatures embedded in stone tools. At Shiawatosla Shelter, researchers uncovered these maize phytoliths dating back nearly 8,700 years, the moment when people first began reshaping wild grass into something edible. Genetic analysis tells the rest. All modern corn descends from a single domestication event in that Balsas Valley. One choice, one community, and one persistent experiment that transformed Teosinte's brittle spikelets into something soft, sweet, and dependent. That decision changed everything. By 7,000 years ago, we started to see that transformation written in stone and in bone. At Gila Nankit's cave in Oaxaca, archaeologists uncovered small early cobs with fused kernels, clear signs that farmers had already bred Teosinte into something recognizably maize-like. A few hundred miles northeast, in the Tehuacan Valley, layers of husk, pollen, and carbonized kernels show continuous cultivation stretching across millennia. Even the people themselves bear witness. Isotopic analysis of ancient skeletons from central Mexico revealed diets that were up to 70% maize, proof that the grass had become the caloric backbone of civilization. And that dependence didn't happen by accident. Sometime around 4,000 years ago, lowland and highland varieties began to hybridize, merging traits for drought resistance, size, and sweetness. The result was a plant that could flourish almost anywhere, from tropical riverbeds to arid mesas, and a food that shaped every calendar, economy, and empire it touched. For the Olmec, the Maya, and later the Aztec, maize wasn't just a crop, it was material of life itself. In the Popol Vuh, which is the Mayan Book of Creation, humans are molded from maize dough by the gods, yellow corn for flesh, white for bone. So, yeah, to them, we literally are what we eat. That reverence turned into ritual. The Aztec goddess Chicomecoatl presided over the harvest, with her effigies paraded through fields thick with pollen, where farmers offered the first cobs of the season in gratitude. Their planting calendars followed the maize's growth, and daily life was paced by germination schedules and rain seasons. Through centuries of patient selection, what began as a brittle grass became a biological marvel. Teosinte's tiny finger-length cobs widened and lengthened into the lush, multi-rowed form we recognize today. A wild plant that had once been self-sustaining and scattered its seeds into the wind had evolved into something that couldn't survive without us. And that's the strange paradox of corn, a triumph of human ingenuity that also proves how symbiotic we've become with the things we eat. It can't live without us, and somewhere along the way, we realized we couldn't live without it either. By the way, if you like the kind of history that hides inside the ordinary and keeps you curious, subscribe and join the journey, because there's a whole world of plants that quietly built the world that we live in. By the time we get to around 5,000 years ago, maize had spread south into the Andes and north into the American Southwest, traded along the same routes that carried obsidian, coca, and jade. Each region reshaped it again. Dense, short-season maize for mountain valleys, sweet, starchy varieties for river basins. It became not just a crop, but a kind of genetic language, adapting wherever humans did. And that adaptability would soon make it unstoppable. Part 2, Flesh of the Gods. Before empire or exploration, maize was already civilization's architecture. Fields weren't just farmlands, they were calendars. Each stage of growth marked a season, a ceremony, and a duty. Farmers timed the rains by the rustling of silk and tassel, the tassel being the male flower that sheds the pollen like a golden dust, and the silk is the thread-like strands of the female ear, each one catching a single grain to form a kernel. Meanwhile, priests read those same signs like scripture. The color of pollen, the pattern of the clouds, the rhythm of wind, it all spoke of fortune. Corn just didn't feed the people, it actually organized them. Across Mesoamerica, maize shaped both art and ethics. Families buried kernels with their dead as insurance for rebirth. Artisans wove funerary masks from husks and cob fibers, faces meant to decay back into the soil. Entire cities pulsed to its rhythm, planting festivals in spring, grinding rituals in autumn, and communal feasts when the granaries refilled. Its genius wasn't just symbolic, it was ecological. The milpa system, which you might know as the Three Sisters, paired maize with beans and squash in a perfect biological loop. Corn offered the scaffolding, beans fixed nitrogen, and squash shaped the ground to lock in moisture. It was agriculture as ecosystem, an early form of what we would now call permaculture. Every harvest was proof that collaboration, not conquest, was the law of survival. Speaking of conquest, and then the strangers came from the sea and turned sustenance into sin. Their sails first appeared in the Caribbean in 1492, when Christopher Columbus set foot on the island tended by the Taino. To them, the visitors seemed divine, pale men from the heavens bringing shining metal and unknowable words. But heaven, as it turned out, was hungry. Within a generation, the Taino world collapsed under disease, slavery, and fire. By 1519, the Spanish had reached the mainland. Hernan Cortes landed on the coast of Mexico and began his march toward Tenochtitlan, a city of canals, temples, and maize markets so vast that one conquistador compared it to Venice. In his letters to the Spanish crown, Cortes marveled at the order and abundance of a people who could feed hundreds of thousands with nothing but corn, beans, and chili peppers. Yet, in true jerk fashion, he called that same abundance a proof of heathen industry. What he couldn't see was that he was walking through a thousand-year-old experiment of ecological harmony, one that would not survive him. Missionaries followed close behind, the Franciscan friar Bernardino de Sahagún, compiling his Florentine Codex in the mid-1500s, documented the Aztec relationship with corn with a mix of fascination and moral panic. He wrote that maize was their life, their flesh, their sustenance, but that its festivals tempted the devil through abundance. These men of God they couldn't reconcile it. To them, faith is built on restraint and sacrifice, while to the Aztec, abundance was a sacred gift from the gods to be enjoyed. So they tried to override it. Sermons replaced corn gods with Christ's bread, the milpa became a metaphor for the Garden of Eden, harvest feasts were rededicated to saints. The same fields that once echoed with song to the rain god Taloc were soon planted in the name of the Father. But under the hymns, the old rituals continued. Cornmeal sprinkled quietly before planting, kernels tucked into the wall for luck. The conversion was never total. Maize simply learned to speak Latin. And speaking of Latin, as colonial ships departed Mexico and the Caribbean, they carried maize to the Old World as both a curiosity and a commodity. The Taíno word maíz became maíz in Spanish, then maize in the Latin of science taxonomy. The plant that had fed gods and nations now appeared in European herbals alongside strange grains of the Indies. In 1539, the Spanish chronicler Gonzalo Fernández de Oviedo wrote that maize sustains Indians in place of wheat, but insisted that it does not nourish as well, nor is it fit for Christians. That was wishful thinking. Maize thrived in poor soils where wheat failed, feeding peasants across southern Europe within decades. But social hierarchy needed its symbols, and corn became coded as peasant food. In Italy, polenta filled the bowls where bread once lay. In France, it was known as blé de Turquie, Turkish wheat, basically seen as an immigrant crop wearing an exotic disguise. Africa took it further. Portuguese traders planted maize along the coasts of Angola and Mozambique, where it soon outcompeted native grains. Enslaved Africans carried knowledge of how to grow it across the Atlantic, turning it into both sustenance and resistance. On Caribbean plantations, cornmeal was seen as both rations and rebellion food, a meal you could cook without permission. It gave you some control back in your life, however little that was. But the crop's speed outpaced its context. The old world learned maize's ways, but forgot its chemistry. By the 1700s, the cost of that arrogance came due. Across peasant villages of Italy, France, and Spain, a new sickness spread among those who lived almost entirely on maize porridge. It began quietly with fatigue, dizziness, and swollen tongues, but soon erupted into madness and lesions that bloomed like bruised petals across the skin. In 1735, Spanish physician Gaspar Casal recorded its symptoms among the poor of the Asturias, calling it mal de la rosa, the sickness of the rose. What he didn't know was that the cure already existed and had for millennia among the very people Europe had conquered. But more on that in a sec. Casal's discovery marked the beginning of nutritional epidemiology, but also one of history's great ironies, a disease not born of scarcity, but of cultural erasure. Europe had misunderstood the plant, but it couldn't abandon it. The world was already addicted to the yield. By the 18th century, maize was already a fixture in every empire's pantry. It fattened livestock in France, it filled slave ships from Senegal to Havana, and traveled inland as meal for workers who never saw a field. British traders used it as ballast, weighing down their ships with grain that would later feed dock workers in London. Portuguese merchants used it as currency, trading sacks of corn along the African coast for captives who, in turn, would be fed the same grain in the Middle Passage. And American planters turned it into profit, planting row after row across the Carolinas and Virginia, feeding both enslaved laborers and the livestock that powered the colonies. Corn's old divinity had been replaced by accounting. The flesh of the gods had become mundane, measured, milled, and monetized. Yet, even as empires traded it like coin, something inside those kernels still held power that no one fully understood. The same biology that once made it sacred would soon make it scientific. For centuries, people treated maize as sacred because it sustained life. Science would soon discover it was even stranger than that. It sustained evolution itself. Part 3. Ghost in the genome. For the civilizations that worshipped it, maize was divine. For the empires that exploited it, it was profit. For the scientists who finally looked inside it, it was chaos. But long before the genome was ever sequenced, Mesoamerican cooks had already performed the first biochemical miracle. They called it nixtamalization. It sounds like sorcery, because frankly, it kind of is. Or at the very least, let's call it culinary alchemy that turns poison into nutrition. Kernels are soaked and boiled in an alkaline bath of wood ash or lime water, which loosens the hulls, softens the starches, and releases niacin, the vitamin B3 molecule essential for human survival. The process also increases protein quality, doubles calcium, and unlocks amino acids that would otherwise stay trapped. To the first Europeans who saw it, this practice looked barbaric. Why would anyone soak grain in lye? So they abandoned it. And in doing so, it broke the spell. By the 1700s, as corn spread across Europe and Africa, the nutrient equation no longer balanced. Without nixtamalization, the body can't absorb niacin. Diets heavy in unprocessed maize led to pellagra, the disease of 4Ds, dermatitis, diarrhea, dementia, and death. Civilizations that perfected the chemistry never suffered it, while those that dismissed indigenous knowledge nearly starved on abundance. What is that phrase? You know, water, water, not a drop to drink, something like that. Modern science finally caught up to it in the 20th century. Researchers traced pellagra's cause to a niacin deficiency, proving that the so-called primitive practice was a sophisticated form of nutritional engineering. Every tortilla, tamale, and pupusa still carries that ancestral lab note. Cook the chemistry, or it will consume you. And once we put those kernels under a microscope, we suddenly saw just how complex this plant really was. So let's break it down. The modern corn genome is a labyrinth about 2.3 billion base pairs long, roughly the size of the human genome. 85% of it is repetitive code. I'm not a scientist. To me, that kind of makes it sound like useless and redundant, right? Thank God I wasn't studying it. Barbara McClintock was. Because to Barbara McClintock, that was everything that mattered. You see, Barbara McClintock wasn't a household name, and she didn't really seem to care to be one. In the 1940s, she was working alone at Cold Spring Harbor. Shout out to Severance fans. It was here that she peered at stained corn chromosomes under a microscope and saw something that shouldn't have been possible. Genes that moved. She called them transposons, but her colleagues called them impossible. The idea that DNA could rearrange itself on command was too out there for the scientific community. Her papers were ignored at best and mocked at worst. She became so frustrated that she stopped publishing for nearly a decade, but the corn kept proving her right. Each variegated kernel, the purples and yellows on a single cob of our beautiful gem corn varieties, was proof that her jumping genes were real. They explained not only color, but also how organisms respond to stress, how they adapt, and how they evolve. Imagine that, a single cob with its color shifting like code, carrying centuries of human interference written right into its skin. When the molecular revolution finally caught up in the 1970s, McClintock's notebooks became scripture. In 1983, at the age of 81, she received the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine, the first woman to win it solo. She used her acceptance speech not to gloat, which she totally would have been within her right to do, but to instead remind everyone that a feeling for the organism mattered as much as the data, meaning that discovery begins with empathy, the ability to let another life form tell you its story. Essentially, she showed that evolution isn't passive, it's narrative. Corn mutates to survive us as much as we alter it to serve ourselves. Our cornfields weren't labs, you know, but they were conversation starters instead. These transposable elements hop across DNA like restless ghosts, rewriting the rules of inheritance. In other words, corn acts like evolution's playground. Every mutation, every hybrid cross, every unexpected color shift is proof that it was built for change. Her patience gave science a new vocabulary for genetic fluidity. It runs through the kernel itself, each seed a tiny factory of sugars, oils, and proteins that humans have learned to weaponize, worship, and occasionally regret. Inside a single kernel is roughly 72% starch, which is used as fuel. About 9 to 11% of that kernel is protein, mostly zeins, a set of storage proteins that have an odd trick. When you extract and dry them, they form a really smooth, flexible film, almost like a plastic. In the early 1900s, factories used zeins to make buttons, coatings, and imitation silk. Today, chemists are experimenting with it again for biodegradable pill capsules and edible packaging. The rest is, a chemistry cornucopia. Ferulic acid for antioxidants, zeaxanthin and lutein for eye health, trace anthocyanins that turn purple corn into a natural anti-inflammatory cocktail. The list goes on. Corn's chemistry is promiscuous. It bonds with everything. Distill it and you get ethanol, a renewable fuel that powers engines. Ferment it and you get bourbon. Polymerize it and you get bioplastics. Crack its starch and you get glucose. process that glucose with an enzyme discovered by Japanese scientists in the 1960s, and you get high fructose corn syrup, a molecule that grows waistlines and balance sheets in equal measure. In 1967, researchers at the Clinton Corn Processing Company in Iowa developed a method to convert glucose into a sweetened compound called fructose using an enzyme named glucose isomerase. By the 1970s, when sugar prices spiked and U.S. corn subsidies made grain cheap, food corporations jumped on it. High fructose corn syrup was marketed as affordable, the natural sweetener of the time, and it quietly took over. By the 1980s, it had infiltrated nearly every processed food and soft drink in America. The same molecule, once worshipped as divine sustenance, had become the biochemical signature of modern consumption. Every can of soda, or pop, if you're right, every granola bar, every light yogurt is a reminder of how the sacred grain of the gods was recast as a profit engine. Its pigments have even joined modern medicine. As I said before, purple maize is rich in anthocyanins, which show anti-diabetic and anti-cancer potential in lab studies, reducing inflammation and improving insulin sensitivity. Extracts from Peruvian varieties are being tested as natural colorants that actually heal rather than harm. The same pathways that once colored ceremonial offerings might one day tint pharmaceuticals. Every part of the planet is exploitable. Husks for textiles, cobs for abrasives, stalks for paper. We've mapped its molecular terrain so completely that almost nothing goes to waste, except perhaps humility. Because in our rush to master it, corn has quietly mastered us. Look at the grocery shelf. It's there in the drinks, the ketchup, the vitamins, the biodegradable bag. It runs through our bloodstreams as sugar and through our fuel lines as ethanol. Roughly 60% of processed foods in the United States contain a corn derivative. We don't just eat it, we inhabit it. What began as sacred sustenance became the blueprint for biotechnology. And in reshaping corn, we may have even taught evolution how to obey us and how to surpass us. Part 4, the monoculture mind. I think it's fair to say corn won. It outlasted the gods that made it, the empires that taxed it, and the scientists who decoded it. But the victory came with strings attached. Today, maize just isn't a crop. It's a system, a machine that runs on chemistry, capital, and control. Rows stretch for miles, every plant cloned for yield, every acre subsidized, monitored, and insured. More than 90 million acres of U.S. farmland are planted in corn every year, and most of it never reaches a table. Like back in colonial America, it feeds livestock, but now it also fuels cars and sweetens nearly everything in the grocery store. And that's the quiet truth of industrial agriculture. The more efficient something becomes, the less alive it feels. But it wasn't always that way. In the 1930s, overplowing and drought turned the Great Plains into a wasteland of dust. The skies went black, and families fled west with everything they owned packed into trucks. It was one of the worst environmental disasters in American history, a warning that was written in sand. When the rain finally returned, federal programs promised to prevent another collapse. The answer was to keep the soil anchored by planting stabilizing corns and rewarding high-yield production. Corn was perfect for that job, deep-rooted, quick to profit, and easy to romanticize as patriotic. It was hardy enough to tame the same ground that had blown away and profitable enough that no one questioned whether it should. Science and subsidies turned disaster into a business model. The Dust Bowl may have ended, but the monoculture it inspired never did. Over the next few decades, that logic only deepened. Mechanization, chemical fertilizers, and hybrid breeding transformed farms into factories. Government slogans promised food for freedom, and corn became the poster child for American abundance. By the 1970s, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture was urging farmers to plant fence row to fence row. Yield skyrocketed, but diversity vanished. The field had become an assembly line. By the 1990s, the Green Revolution had evolved into the Gene Revolution. Monsanto rolled out Roundup Ready and SmartStax hybrids, which were seeds engineered to shrug off herbicides and kill insects from the inside out. Farmers who once saved kernels now signed contracts that forbade it, bound to patented DNA. By the 2000s, U.S. corn subsidies had ballooned so large that it was cheaper to sweeten soda than to grow vegetables, a quiet policy that rewired global diets. The ecological bill for all of this is so steep. Fertilizer runoff from the Corn Belt feeds a 6 100,000-square-mile dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico every summer, starving marine life of oxygen. Monocropping strips topsoil faster than it can heal, and nitrogen emissions heat the same climate corn depends on. Even the air smells of it now, ethanol, exhaust, and decay. Still, resistance grows. Across the Americas, indigenous farmers are revisiting the rainbow of maize that once covered the continent. Blue, red, black, and gold, and every heirloom seed they replant is an act of rebellion. That movement hasn't slowed down. From Mexico's anti-GMO protests in the 2000s to today's indigenous seed banks, every kernel saved is proof the story isn't finished. And still, the cornfield haunts our imagination. It's the symbol of America itself, part comfort and part uncanny. The whispering rose of the children of the corn, the ghostly diamond of Field of Dreams, the scream of the band Korn, even the viral grin of hashtag Korn Kid, all nostalgia and nightmare rolled into one. Still, through all of our attempts to make everything neat and tidy, corn keeps misbehaving. Wild maize still sprouts in ditches. Mutations keep rewriting its genes. Farmers, scientists, and kids on TikTok keep rediscovering its strange beauty. Corn endures, not because it's obedient, but because it never stops changing. I'm Megan Rahm. Thank you for joining me on another episode of The History of Plants. Jump into the commentary episode on Patreon for bonus content, or keep the story going with my next deep dive on pokeweed, the plant that uses poison to play the long game. Until next time, greenies, stay curious and don't forget to flourish.